Hi, everybody. This is Ben Starr with you with The Positive Mind, bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life here on 99.5 FM WBAI New York. And if you were tuned in last week, we were talking about the concept of link and flow. We were talking about our own happiness and being responsible for our happiness in terms of living here in the moment, in the present. And that was a conversation that I had with Kevin O'Donohue of the DeMel Center, who's back here with me today. Kevin, welcome back.
Thanks, Ben. Good to be here.
And we had this discussion last week, and we had a lot of phone calls and emails and feedback on it. And we had the opportunity to speak with someone who we found to be a very interesting person with a lot to contribute to the show and a lot to help us out with in terms of talking to our listeners, to all of you in the audience. So that's why I'd like to welcome to the studio Dr. Loretta Bruning, the author of Habits of a Happy Brain and the founder of the Inner Mammal Institute. Welcome, Dr. Bruning.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. It's great to have you. And we saw your book, and it was real interesting to us, Kevin and I and Julian and those of us who are here at the DeMel Center, because it really fits in line with the legacy of the Positive Mind here of comparing humans and animals and understanding the human brain by looking at the animal brain and by understanding our own hopes and wants and desires and fears by looking at how evolution and survival instincts have shaped our modern brains. And so that's why we wanted to have you come on and tell us a little bit about the modern brain and tell our listeners a little bit about the chemicals that make up our modern brain.
Great.
Yeah.
Sure.
So first of all, welcome. I want to just touch briefly on your book. Your book highlights four major chemicals as the chemicals that kind of make up our brain chemistry. I thought we could start by hearing a little bit about those chemicals, and I'll just say Kevin and I have this mnemonic device that we use to remember them. We use the
mnemonic.
Does. Right. Does.
Dopamine, oxytocin, endorphins, and serotonin.
Absolutely.
Do so your does.
We
or
wanted,
dose.
Yeah,
we could change it to dose.
Dose, right. Your dose of happiness. That works too. Okay. But Dr. Bruning, tell us a little bit on the basics about these four chemicals, starting with dopamine.
Okay, great. First, I'll mention you referred to the book. It's called Habits of a Happy Brain, Retrain Your Brain to Boost Your Serotonin, Dopamine, Oxytocin, and Endorphin Levels. And so many people have used that dose, but does, I love that, because does is the whole point of the book, that you have to do something to activate your happy chemicals. They did not evolve to just be on all the time and flow for no reason. They evolved to reward you when you take a step to meet a survival need. So I'll explain that one at a time. So since we're doing the does, I'll do them in that order.
Great.
So dopamine is the feeling. We could call it anticipation. It's the feeling of excitement you get when you expect to meet a need. Now, your brain has been defining needs in ways since the moment of birth. Each time your dopamine was stimulated, each time you met a need, that built up your neural pathways that turns on the feeling of dopamine that says, this is going to be good. This is going to meet your needs. This is going
to
be good.
So let's talk about a specific need. Let's say the need to eat. Right. The when you anticipate meeting that need, let's say you smell a meal that's cooking, it smells really good, or you go and you buy groceries. Would that qualify as anticipation of meeting a need?
Yeah, that's one way to look at it. But I'll give you two very different ways of looking at it. One is, let's say I'm on a camping trip. I get lost. I haven't eaten for hours and hours. And I stumble on some food that I would normally, let's just say saltine crackers. I normally think, ugh, I don't want to eat. But like those saltines are like the best thing I ever ate when I'm starving.
Mm.
So when, depending on the
There's
need.
There's a great Eddie Murphy stand-up comedy skit about just that, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when it's a real need of real hunger, you know, anything is like you're thrilled. You see those saltines 20 feet in the distance, and oh my God, I'm ripping open the package, I'm thrilled. But in the average course of modern life, if you're satiated, then another interesting example would be, I decide I'm going to bake a loaf of bread. And so I'm shopping for the ingredients, I'm watching the yeast grow.
There's this buildup happening.
I'm smelling it baking in the oven. Wow, this is going to be good. But then, have you ever had that feeling? Like, you've had two or three bites, and then it's like, oh, okay, so now what?
It's called Christmas.
There you go.
Yeah.
So all this excitement leading up to Christmas, and then Christmas comes, and it's over in 2020, and what happened?
Yeah, well,
every kid can relate to that.
I think everyone's had the experience of cooking a meal, putting a lot of effort into it, and it's almost like that preparation and that the process of creating it is more fulfilling than the actual sitting down and eating it afterwards.
Yeah, so it helps to understand the brain we've inherited from our ancestors. So whether you could think of your human ancestors or your animal ancestors, they could not go to the refrigerator. So they had to constantly stimulate themselves to look for the next meal. And if you waited until you were starving, you'd actually run out of energy and you could die. So dopamine is what releases your reserve tank of energy and makes it feel good. Either I'm starving and it makes it feel good to take another step, or I'm not hungry. Dopamine rewards me for curiosity. Oh, that looks interesting. Oh, maybe there's a berry bush behind over the next hill. So,
okay, so let me interrupt a second, because we should tell the audience, maybe it'd be a good thing to get a pen and paper for today, because
definitely,
you're going to be learning a lot. We're going to be talking about the mammalian brain and all of these brain chemicals that you can take control of and charge of. If you really want to feel dopamine today, just don't eat until 10 o'clock tonight.
Sure.
And when you start eating, you will know what dopamine feels like.
Absolutely.
Or actually before you
get it. Yeah, before, when you have the food in front of you and you're ready to start eating. So let's move on to oxytocin real quick. What's the basis of oxytocin?
Okay, but just also very quickly, I want to mention dopamine is not just about food in the modern world. So you want to feel dopamine very quick, what I say is clean out your sock drawer. You know, like that one, like, I can't close my drawer because of too much crap in it. And like, I could solve that in 10 minutes. And then it's like, oh, I feel good. I got something done. So it's any time you get something done that meets a need.
Fantastic. So there are multiple ways of satisfying and boosting certain
chemistries. Well, many ways as there are needs, right?
Yes, as long as you feel the need.
Sure.
Okay.
So oxytocin. So oxytocin, I often say, like, some people haven't heard of it and other people it has like a cult following, but it's complicated. So oxytocin is the good feeling, we could say in the state of nature, of touch and trust.
The cuddle chemical.
The cuddle chemical, the love hormone, the bonding hormone. And that all sounds fabulous, and that's why it has a cult following, but it has a downside as well. So if we think of it from the animal perspective, if I'm a gazelle, if I wander away from my herd, then I could get eaten within a split second. And once I figure that out, it's sort of too late. So oxytocin is the chemical that makes me feel good when I stick with the herd. So it's not a cognitive, conscious decision to stick with the herd. But when you're near me, I feel safe. I feel good. And how near? Who do I let near? Those are all things your brain wires in from past experience. And when you step away from that circle of trust that your brain has wired in, your oxytocin falls and you start feeling like a gazelle that's exposed to a predator.
How much of our reproductive or sexual instinct as mammals is driven by the need or the desire for oxytocin?
Very much. Good question. So I might add that sex is a large dose of oxytocin in a short amount of time. And because oxytocin equals trust, you could say that sex is a lot of trust in a short amount of time, and then it's over. And then there's suddenly no trust. So unless you build other trust bonds within the context of that sexual relationship, you're going to be up and down, which is why we really benefit from building multiple trust bonds.
And cultivating common interests and different types of things where you spend time together and will be together with your partner other than sex. So,
absolutely.
Oxytocin. And tell me about oxytocin and being pregnant. Does it spike when a woman is pregnant?
So this is fascinating, and this is what makes mammals different from reptiles. So first, I'll just directly answer, and anyone with any medical background knows this. Oxytocin causes contractions, and because of that, when the mother releases a lot of it in the birth process, a baby is born with oxytocin. So we are born helpless and vulnerable, and more helpless than any other creature in nature. But we're born with a shot of oxytocin that helps mother and child bond to each other. And you may all know, excuse me for getting maybe too clinical, but you may have heard that oxytocin releases the mother's milk. But the interesting thing is it's all gone in a few minutes, like all of these. You get some oxytocin, and then it's gone. So if you think of a mother lion licks her cub, and that stimulates more. A mother human cuddles her baby, that stimulates more. If I'm a baby, like a year old, and I build up the courage to step away from my mother, and then I'm so excited, and then I'm like, yikes, I'm all alone.
Like the little kid who gets lost in a supermarket.
Yeah, and then you run back and you cuddle your mother's ankle, right?
Right.
And that re-stimulates your oxytocin.
Very interesting. How about a couple? A couple that puts their arm around each other or holds hands. Is that a re-stimulation of the oxytocin?
Absolutely. Yes. Yes.
And for the viewer, I mean, when I see somebody holding hands, I wonder, do I get an oxytocin rush by seeing that?
Or interesting. You know, it depends on your association. Okay. So if you think of, oh, that reminds me of my loved one, I'm going to go home and hold hands with them. Or if you have a negative association, then for you that might trigger cortisol. But what the holding hands, again, it's a sense of trust. So if I'm going to hold your hand, but I'm thinking, oh, you must be so scared. Oh, you know, and I'm projecting my fears onto you. That's not oxytocin.
Right, right. Well, oxytocin, from what I understand from your book, and we're talking with Dr. Bruning, author of Habits of a Happy Brain, Retrain Your Brain to Boost Your Serotonin, Dopamine, Oxytocin, and Endorphin Levels. From the book, I understand oxytocin really stimulates trust and safety and love in the mammal brain. So, I mean, what else would you say the purpose of oxytocin is beyond that?
Protection, protectiveness.
Acceptance and belonging is what it is. So, yeah, it's acceptance. Like, it sounds like, oh, love is nice. Let's just have oxytocin all the time. Well, no, because if I felt protected by people who were then, in fact, not there for me, then that would threaten my survival. So your brain evolved to promote survival. So it's always saying, is this good for me? Oh, yes, you have my back. Now I'm going to release the oxytocin. Mm. It's not a cognitive thing. Mm. So you could be someone that I hate. We could be in the middle of divorce proceedings. But if you do some tiny thing that says, ah, you know, you're not that bad at all. You're going to... Mm. You know, I can trust you.
Right. It's a good feeling. When you do, does that mean oxytocin is flowing as opposed to dopamine, which is... I wonder. We're just experimenting here.
Yeah,
so we've got D and O covered, dopamine and oxytocin. And now we'll go to endorphins.
Yeah. So endorphin is an interesting. They all have their surprising downside. So endorphin is only stimulated by physical pain, which is very surprising. Endorphin got famous from runner's high. And one of the reasons it's so famous is that it was the first brain chemical to really get a lot of research and attention. And people got the idea that runner's high was this like everyday thing to go for. But the sad fact is that runners do not get it every day. They only get it when they run to the point of pain. Yikes, that's not a good survival strategy to say, oh, now I got to get to the point of pain every day. So
feel the burn.
So bottom line, in the animal world, endorphin masks pain with a feeling of oblivion, or humans would call it ecstasy. So when you see on those nature videos that a zebra has its flesh ripped open by a lion, gash in its side, but it's still able to run to safety to save its life. Endorphin surges for 20 minutes to mask pain so we can do what it takes to save our lives. For example, a caveman with a broken leg can save his life. But after 20 minutes, endorphin stops because pain is an important survival information.
I guess that's like you hear about people who perform these acts of superhuman strength under duress and under pain.
No, that's adrenaline, right? Would that be adrenaline?
You know, I think it's both.
It is.
That's
okay.
Good. Yeah, it's a good question. Yeah.
Yeah, so endorphin, in any case, it makes me think of a few things. It makes me think of, I've heard fighters and both people who fight in a ring in sanctioned fights and people who are just kind of brawlers who like to fight anyone they can find. I've heard people say that it actually, one of their favorite feelings in the world is to get hit in the face. And, you know, to your everyday person, that sounds almost unbelievable. But there are a lot of people who swear by it. And now when you're hearing you talk about endorphins and being linked to pain, well, it makes a lot of sense, doesn't it?
Yeah. I almost hesitate to give examples, so I just have to say that I'm absolutely not advocating that we inflict pain on ourselves to feel good with oxytocin. I'm saying it's the one brain chemical that we need to say, I'm grateful I have it for emergencies, but I am not expected to have it. However, the good news is that laughing stimulates a little bit, which sounds counterintuitive, but you could say that it jiggles your innards in a way that is not useful. It's like activating muscles that don't usually get activated. And even like a stretch, again, a stretch gives you a little, but if I keep stretching the same thing, that's not good for me. So if we're happy with a little, definitely make laughing part of your day.
So you're only talking about physical pain, right? When you talk about the link of pain and endorphins, not emotional pain or mental pain.
Yeah, that's the glitch with the human brain. Emotional pain does not stimulate endorphin, which is why there's that ever-present temptation to intake artificial sources. And morphine and endorphin are the same thing. That's what the word endorphin means, endogenous morphine.
Really?
And morphine is the raw example of any number of synthetic
drugs. Sure. Any opiate class substances, and they are, you know, as we know, some of the most addictive substances out there. So
yes, and I just might mention the reason they're addictive is because you're getting them in non-natural quantities without the pain. So your brain is saying, wow, this is the best thing I've ever felt, but it's not like anything that's available in nature. No zebra is going to go say, hey, lion, would you bite me again? That felt really good.
Incredible. So, if you're just joining us, you're tuning into The Positive Mind here on 99.5 FM WBAI. I'm Ben Starr, joined in the studio by Kevin O'Donohue and Dr. Loretta Bruning. She's the founder of the Inner Mammal Institute, which I want to get to in a moment. And she's written a book called Habits of a Happy Brain, How to Retrain Your Brain to Boost Your Serotonin, Dopamine, Oxytocin, and Endorphin Levels. We've discussed three of these chemicals so far. We've touched on dopamine, oxytocin, and endorphin. Let's just quickly hear about serotonin, if we could.
Yeah, this is the tough one. So we're all familiar with hearing about serotonin in the context of antidepressants, but it's fascinating to know that serotonin is in all animals. Reptiles, even mollusks have serotonin. It's mind-boggling.
Wow.
So what is the job that it does? It has to have a natural job. The other amazing thing is 90% of your serotonin is in your digestive system. So what is this job that it does? Well, in the state of nature, it just so happens, brace yourself because this is the unpleasant fact of life, is animals have food fights. Like most of the time, and they have competition over food. And so in a mammal group, you're always surrounded with potential social rivals. So if I see a banana and you see a banana, my brain evolved to compare me to you. And if you're a lot bigger than me, then I know that I'm better off doing without this one banana than getting bitten by you.
Because the risk of losing a fight, right,
yes,
outweighs
yes.
the potential benefit
yes.
of maybe getting this banana.
Yes. So when I perceive that risk, that triggers cortisol, and cortisol motivates me to withdraw. But if I perceive that I'm bigger than you, then serotonin is released, and it's like I have the self-confidence to say, I'm going to go for that banana. So it's not aggression, it's self-confidence.
So is serotonin the one of these chemicals that you would say is most linked to confidence?
Yes, it
self-confidence?
Is. Self-confidence? Yeah, yeah. Although I would say dopamine is most linked to, let's say, positive expectations. So they're similar.
And so depressed people, I wonder if depressed people are could be summarized in one level of being having a lack of confidence or a lack of feeling of social competence or success or something?
Well, this is the medical model of it, the idea that there's some right level that we should just be having twinkling in our brains and our bodies all the time, and then something may have gone wrong. But the way I see it is we're all born needy, and we have to learn to wait to trigger a little more. Then you got to take another step to trigger a little more. And every one of us is stuck in the same boat. It's like we got to keep finding ways to trigger them. Now, if you read about primatology and how do monkeys trigger it, it's like, yikes, they're constantly tussling with each other. And we don't want to be doing that. So in the human world, we're constantly restraining ourselves from grabbing for that banana. So how can I feel good about my serotonin without dominating someone else? It's a really hard conundrum. Mm. And that's why the modern adaptation is to say, I'm going to make myself feel good about my prospects, knowing that I don't really need a banana, my belly's kind of full, and if I just need to show you who has power over that banana, then we're not going to be friends in the long run. So it's very hard to make these decisions, but the good news is that that's the job our brain evolved to do, is to live with a bunch of other monkeys and constantly make these hard calls.
And the secret is to know who's the top banana.
Yep.
And when to give it up, and when to cut your banana in half.
Excellent.
So,
well, you know, we touched briefly on cortisol, and I think that's the sort of the last major chemical that we need to identify here before we continue our discussion. So far, we've heard about dopamine, which is sort of the anticipation chemical, oxytocin, which is the social kind of safety and trusting chemical, endorphins, which are the sort of nature's own painkiller, if you would. They're almost nature's version of morphine, right?
Yeah, or you could say
morphine is
the industry's version.
Morphine
of
is synthetic, synthetic endorphin, right? And serotonin, which you know, Dr. Bruning's described as the kind of self-confident social pride chemical. These are all vital chemicals in terms of our happiness and how we feel within our brain. But let's hear quickly about what cortisol is and how it affects the brain and how it acts on our behavior.
So cortisol is the brain's emergency broadcast system. So let's go back to something really simple, a reptile. So a reptile, I always say, when you see a reptile lying in the sun, you think, oh, he must be feeling good. But in fact, when they're out in the sun, they could get eaten in a second by a predator. But if they go back and hide under a rock, then they can die of hypothermia. So a reptile is constantly thinking, okay, am I about to die from cold or am I about to die from predator? And constantly avoiding what is the most immediate threat. So our brain is designed to constantly avoid the most immediate threat. Now, many people have problematized this, but it's good to just accept that that's your brain's natural alert system to say, I'm on the lookout for potential risks, and that gives me the freedom to go out in the world and look for new things, because when I see a risk, I can withdraw.
Yes, you say problematized, but I think some people are trained, actually, to believe that they don't have to look out for themselves, and they can just sit back and wait for their brain chemistry to kick in to get them to motivate and do things.
Yeah, and other people somehow think, well, stress is a social problem. I'm not creating it. Society is creating it. And other people may think, well, I have a stress problem. But I just think it's helpful to think everyone has a stress problem and to just say stress is doing a job, but I can focus on something else other than potential threats.
And this hooks into what we were talking about last week about linking and flowing. Yes, your tendency is to link your current experience with things that have happened in the past, and sometimes that can take you down a road that makes you feel bad. Or you can choose to be in the present and live in flow, and possibly even generate these happy chemicals and get yourself to do the things that really will serve you instead of making you wait for somebody else to do things for you.
Sure.
Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yeah. And there's always something you can do. So instead of abstracting some ideal view of what you need to do to be happy, to just know, if I have 5 minutes, if I have 10 minutes, if I have an hour, and I'm always choosing, oh, I can do this. Anytime you step toward anything that meets a need, you can feel good.
Flow.
Incredible.
Meeting your needs now.
And it's all so, so tied to thousands of years of evolution and how our brains, basically our brains, you know, the successful behaviors, well, those were passed on because those of our ancestors who had these successful behaviors were the ones successfully reproducing, right?
Well, here's the complication. So we're all born with billions of neurons, but almost no connections between them. So that's the thing about being a mammal. So reptiles, they leave home the instant they're born, and if they don't leave fast enough, they're eaten by a parent. So that means they're already hardwired with all the survival needs, with survival behaviors they need. But a mammal has to learn from life experience. So each of us learns from the rewards we experienced when we were young. They build connections between our neurons, and we say, that's what I need to do.
And think about how long it takes the human being to reach adulthood versus other creatures.
Exactly.
I mean, it takes us, right, 15, 20 years to...
Or so.
To become, you know, at least physically mature.
Yes, and the reason it's so cool, there's an exact correlation between the size of a brain and the length of a childhood. And so the bigger a creature's brain, the longer, the more vulnerable a state it's born into, and the more it's dependent on, the longer it's dependent on a parent. And the reason's very simple. Neurons are hard to keep alive. So they really make it harder to survive unless you get your money's worth out of them. And the way you get your money's worth is by wiring them from your unique life experience rather than the knowledge of your ancestors, which is why all kids think their parents are dumb, because we're all wired with our experience rather than their experience.
Yes, yes. I know you do a lot of work with zoos, and I know you do a lot of work with teaching people about animals and with zoos, you know, and you do this work at zoos, from what I understand. You help people understand animal behavior and animal instincts. What are some other animals? I mean, you mentioned that the size of the brain is directly related to the length of childhood. Well, I would say humans probably have the longest childhood, right?
Yeah. So here's an interesting example. Like, a gazelle can run with the herd like a day after it's born. A mouse can be a parent at 2 months old and a grandparent at 4 months old. So humans take a long time because we take longer to learn the skills that it takes to survive. We learn more complex skills. So, for example, chimpanzees learn more complex skills than monkeys.
Absolutely. And I want to hear a lot more about that when we come back. We're going to take a quick musical break, and we'll be back with more questions for Dr. Loretta Bruning. Thanks for being tuned into 99.5 FM WBAI. It's The Positive Mind.
Falling in love again, never wanted to. What am I to do? Can't help me. Love's always been my game, play it as I may. I was born that way, can't help it. Men flock around me like moths around the flame. So if their wings burn, I know I'm not to blame. Falling in love again, never wanted to. What am I
Holiday, Falling in Love Again, here on The Positive Mind, 99.5 FM, WBAI. I'm Ben Starr, here in the studio with Kevin O'Donohue and Dr. Loretta Bruning, who I thank both of you for joining me today. We will be taking your calls if you have a question for Dr. Bruning about the nature of the human brain and how we got this way and how these chemicals figure into our behavior and our lives. So that number to call is 212-757-5555 if you have any questions for Dr. Bruning. And we are talking about brain chemicals, how they relate to animals. We've covered five chemicals so far, and they are dopamine, endorphin, oxytocin, serotonin, and cortisol, which is kind of the scary one, the one that we all try to avoid, whether consciously or subconsciously. And just before the break, we were talking about how humans take the longest to develop. I'm wondering if you could just name us a few other animals that take relatively long time to get through childhood.
Well, the simple thing is sort of like our cortex is three times as big as an ape, whose cortex is three times as big as a monkey, who's three times as big as like a dog. I mean, this is very, very general, and it's adjusting because of the proportionality of the cortex and the body and all that. So it's very simple rule. But here's like a fascinating example, I think. The skills that an animal has to learn, you probably have seen like this image of like just hanging out in the jungle, picking fruit, and it looks easy, but it's really quite complex. And people have probably heard that chimpanzees can pick a certain leaf when they have a certain illness. They know just what to do. But here's a mind-blowing one. I watch this on YouTube all the time. Monkeys, they need to crack open nuts in order to get protein, but it's very hard to do, and your mom will never feed you. You only get breast milk in the state of nature. So it takes a monkey like 10 years of struggling to crack open a nut before they figure it out. And when they do, then they have the protein that it takes to build muscles, to compete for mating opportunity, and to build rich milk that keeps your children alive. So you got to really get the skill, and it takes a lot of effort.
Yeah, it's interesting how you talk about monkeys competing for mating opportunity, because, you know, as humans, don't we do that all the time? I mean, we all compete for mating opportunities, whether or not, right, that we explicitly say that that's what we're doing, but that is what we're doing.
Yes, absolutely. And it's very frustrating to people, but we're so much aware of it in others. You know, these emotions feel very pure in ourselves. I like to say that we read our own press releases. And in other people, it just looks like it's mindless competition.
Right, right.
So in the state of nature, status is very central to mating opportunity. And that's why we don't like to admit it, but status is very central to our mating choices.
Right. So money in our world is very important for status. Or what would the things be for mating opportunities in New York City? To outdo your competitors in New York City.
Yeah. Well, there's a zillion different factors, right? So once you go, you know, mating is nice. Money is nice. This is nice. That's nice. Nice kind of muscles. But I'll give you the funniest example. I had a visitor from the UK, and a number of us were bringing her to our homes. And I said, oh, my husband cooked us breakfast. My husband cooked us lunch. And I thought, that's the status symbol in America, is that your husband cooks.
<That's> you <bet. laughs>
Amazing. Well, we have a caller on the line. We have Beth, who wanted to ask you a question, Dr. Bruning. So, Beth, thanks for calling in today.
Hello.
Yes. Hello, Beth.
Hi there. Oh, thank you. I'm just fascinated with this discussion. And I'd like to talk about our sexy relation about the bonobo. I understand. Well, I even made a little poem about it. As I hoped and suspected, I believe we're connected. Pleasure-seeking just can't be assumed with genital rubbing instead of bashing and clubbing. It's a bonobo I want for my kin.
Yes, the bonobo, as I recall, it's the only other animal that has sex for pleasure, right, instead of procreation.
Right.
And face
so
to face.
So what kind of brain chemicals are going on, and how can we humans learn more about
Well, here's the complicated facts of life. I know the bonobos have been very much idealized, but here's the idea. Let's say you and I are hanging out on a branch of a tree and you're in my way. So instead of biting you, I'm going to rub your genitals. So on the one hand, it sounds nice, but if I'm like obligated to go through life rubbing people's genitals in order to not have them hassle me, there's a bit of pressure. So that's one
I'd
side
say
of it.
So.
And it's true, I'm not making this up. You can't make this stuff up, right?
Worse ways to make a living, though.
So here's the other thing. Bonobos are often idealized for being matriarchal, but the case is that in matriarchal species, the females tend toward violence. So two female bonobos have the strength to take on a male. So females, people like to idealize cooperation in the state of nature, but females will cooperate in order to beat up a male. But here's the worst part of all.
They're still doing it.
I know. It's true. It's true. So here's the thing. They're not happy to have sex with just anyone. They make themselves nuts to get the best partner, just like we do. So the way it works is that female bonobos fight with each other to have sex with the son of the queen, of the highest ranking female. And so that male is like a mama's boy that just has women fighting over him because of who his mama is.
Blackmail or something like that. Gosh,
So every system has its kinks.
Absolutely. And Beth, thank you so much for the call. It's always good to hear from our listeners.
Fascinating.
If anyone else wanted to ask a question of Dr. Bruning here, you can reach us at 212-757-5555. We've talked about the brain chemicals that lead towards happiness and the brain chemicals that spur us to action, right, like cortisol. How do we use this information now in our lives in a practical way to better understand ourselves and to take steps forward to kind of harness these chemicals and understand why and where they come up?
Great. First, I feel bad that I wanted to say that Beth's poem was brilliant and the rhyming was really cool, and I just was so busy answering that I forgot to say that. So how can we use this to get more happy chemicals in our lives? I'm going to give a quick answer, but just so you know that I have lots and lots of resources on my website that will explain this in any format you want. And specifically, I have slideshows that put this in a very step-by-step format.
Innermammalinstitute.org.
And then if you go to Free Stuff, the books are there, of course, but if you go to Free Stuff, and then there's infographics, there's slideshows, there's videos, so you can reinforce this in every format. So we could just take them one at a time and say, how would I get more? So with dopamine is what makes us feel good when we step toward a goal. Now, the good news is, well, if I, you know, get something done, I feel like I'm stepping toward a goal. But we all know that there are obstacles on the path of our goals, and then we get frustrated. So what I suggest is to always have in mind a short-run goal, a medium-run goal, and a long-run goal, so I can fluidly shift among them so that whenever I'm blocked in one department, I could focus on another department.
Right. So if you're trudging on the third mile of the marathon and all you're thinking about is the finish line, it's going to be a long day for you. So, you know, you break it down. Let me get to mile 5. Let me get to mile 8. Let me get to mile 10. Is that it?
Yes, exactly. But to put it more in the context of our lives, if I think I want to be a rock star, and so I'm constantly working and I can't be happy for 1 minute until I'm a rock star, well, then what I say is the tabloids are public service announcement because they let you know that once you're a rock star, you're still not going to be happy.
Right.
So you may as well, on the way, think, okay, what could I do to be happy in the next few minutes?
Enjoy the process in the present. Be in flow as you seek the goal.
We're gonna take another call quickly. We have a caller on the line, Pete. Thank you so much for calling in. You had a question for Dr. Bruning.
Yes, I'd like to know: are we dealt a certain amount of the dose, the chemical in our brain, or can it be augmented by supplements. I know we can use it because I was an athlete and I used to, and it is true, sometimes when you get hit, you come back and you do feel better. So than boxing, but or running and anything. I understand that. But are certain people predestined for just a certain amount? You know, like you might find somebody who's very taciturn and one, they don't get excited and they just sit, and then there are other people that go out and dance and can do it all night long, but they're
there's
a certain amount that we like, you know, it's like there's, okay, let me give you an example. Like the 505 pound lift, weightlifting record. Okay, that was a plateau, never to be beaten, or whatever. But mentally and emotionally, do we have the same limitations?
Okay, here's a simple answer. Every one of us gets wired in our puberty years because that's when we have our peak of neuroplasticity. So every one of us has circuits to turn on our happy chemicals in ways that worked in our teen years. So one person, let's say, got happy rewards from studying for a math test. Another person got happy rewards for, let's say, going to parties. So every one of those has its limitations. If I spend my life doing nothing but being studious, I'm going to miss out on something. If I spend my life doing nothing but partying, I'm going to miss out on something. So every one of us is challenged to continually try to build up our reward circuits in more diverse ways, because everybody's teen years, of course, is limited. We can't have complete awareness of the fullness of life at that age. So
it sounds like Pete's question was basically, in short, about people's nature when it comes to brain chemicals. Would you say that's right, Pete? It came about nature.
Yes.
And also, it sounds like your answer was about nurture, right? Like your answer, Dr. Bruning, was almost about how our formative years can really play a role in the behaviors and brain chemicals later down the line.
Yes, whatever turns on your brain chemicals is whatever the super highways that you built when you were young. And that's going to be limited from every one of us. So if I were a prize fighter, I think he used that example, when I was young, then that felt good to me when I was young. That got rewarded. And my brain now says, you want to be special? You want to feel good? This is the way to do it. But then I reach some limit where I think, gee, getting knocked out over and over, is that all there is? But it doesn't apply just to, it's every single one of us. Whatever we did in the past that felt good, it's like if we just repeat that one thing, it's going to have diminishing returns because the brain habituates.
Thanks for the call, yeah. Pete. And we want to try to get a couple more calls in before the end of the program, but I appreciate your question.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Which brings up the point about familiarity versus unfamiliarity. And that's one of the things you promote in the book, is to enjoy the unfamiliar and get away from your familiar patterns.
Yes, but the complicated thing is when you change that path, it doesn't feel good immediately.
Right.
And that's what makes it so hard to do. So the fun example is people say, you know, I'd love to do more of X. But then when they do it, it doesn't feel good immediately. So what I talk about in the book is do X for 45 days and you will build a new neural pathway that will make electricity flow and then it will start to feel good. But when you're using an undeveloped neural pathway, it feels wrong because our brain is so used to using the developed neural pathway.
And that's something that you touch on a lot in your book. The Habits of a Happy Brain is this sort of this idea that you give us about the 45-day rewiring of your brain chemistry. And we're going to get into a lot of that tomorrow with Dr. Bruning, who's going to be back on our program tomorrow because there's so much to talk about. So if you want to hear about how you can actually rewire and retrain your brain, tune in tomorrow and we're going to have this this whole discussion about how Dr. Bruning feels that we can do that, and we can do that just out of repetition, if I'm not mistaken. Is that correct?
Absolutely, yes.
So for now, we'd love to take another call or two before the end of the show, 212-757-5555, with any questions for Dr. Bruning. And you are listening to The Positive Mind. I'm Ben Starr here with Kevin O'Donohue. Our guest is Loretta Bruning. She is the author of Habits of a Happy Brain, Retrain Your Brain to Boost Your Serotonin, Dopamine, Oxytocin, and Endorphin Levels. She's also the founder of the Inner Mammal Institute, and I'd love to hear a little bit about that, and a professor at Cal State University. So it's great to have you here. Tell us about the Inner Mammal Institute.
It's a resource for information on stimulating your happy brain chemicals in new ways. So it has every form of information you could want, because I hear from lots of readers who tell me which form they like information in, and I've tried to create all of them, including even in French and Spanish.
Right.
Fantastic. And I've always been fascinated on a personal level with the similarities between people and animals. You know, and I've always felt that the monkey was my spirit animal, for lack of a better term. I feel a real personal connection. Anytime I, you know, watch a documentary on, you know, monkeys, I just feel like there's so much to learn and so much of ourselves that we see in them that it's really fascinating. And I think it's a very useful tool to use nature metaphors to explain our condition.
Well, we can see their struggles, and we can see our struggles in their struggles, right? I mean,
yeah, well, and chemically, so they have the exact same brain chemicals that we have, managed by the exact same brain structures. So people have heard about, like, the hippocampus, the hypothalamus, the amygdala. Monkeys have the exact same thing.
Hmm.
The difference is we have extra structures added on, but our extra structures are mostly just a reserve. It's sort of like having extra RAM that we can put extra info in, but the operating system is the same.
Interesting. You talk about making it fun to change your brain chemistry. Instead of, like, it's this 45-day marathon, make it fun as you go. Tell us about that a little bit.
Yeah, so let's try to think of an example. So hypothetically, I'll say, let's say you're looking for a better job. Either you're looking for a job or a better job. And, like, yeah, it's not really fun, maybe. Or some other thing that you want to get yourself to do, whatever
right.
it is. So how can you make it fun? So let's say I tell myself, first break it down into small steps. I'm going to write one job application, and then I'm going to give myself a reward. But it's not like 5 minutes of job application and then a whole box of cookies. So you have to create some realistic expectations about that. But let's say a really challenging job application, and then a reward of, like, that novel that I always wanted to read. I'm going to let myself read it for 15 minutes and then do another job application.
Right.
We're
going
to take one last call. We have Mary Jo on the line. Thank you so much for the call, Mary Jo.
Hi, how you doing, guys?
Good. It was good to hear from you. How's everything?
Pretty good so far. But I do have a question regarding smoking. Unfortunately, I'm a smoker, and it's extremely difficult to quit. How does it affect the neurotransmitters? Because there is obviously some pleasure with smoking, you know, physically,
yes.
Not so much, but, you know, how much does the neurotransmitter play a part in the addiction?
Great question.
Yeah, so I know everyone's heard the dopamine theory of addiction, but here's something you haven't heard. And I have this story in the book. It's so fascinating. I learned this from one of these stop smoking hypnotherapists. So imagine, he said, that you're a 14-year-old boy at a party and you want to talk to a girl, but you're really scared. And then you have a cigarette, and then you have the courage and you talk to the girl and she likes you. So your brain, now nothing is more important at age 14 than reproductive success. So your brain builds the hugest neural pathway that says the way to survive is to have a cigarette. So whatever is that first moment where you do something that feels good during a moment when you feel threatened, your brain built a superhighway that says, this is what you gotta do. And it's hard to overcome that, but when you know where that feeling comes from, it really helps then to say, oh, I'm going to then just build a new pathway to, whenever I feel threatened, to focus on something else. And when you first start, it's going to be a very small neural pathway rather than a superhighway, but you can build it up.
This is a really important thing. I mean, certainly in therapy, you want to take the client back to a place where the first temptation, the first step in this certain direction that, you know, ruined their lives or made their lives more difficult, get them back to that place, get them to see what it is they went through, and walk them and show them they have access to another neural pathway. So I think this is really, really interesting.
And you know what's so funny is the boy is not consciously saying, oh, I made a connection
right.
between smoking and a hot girl
right.
liking
it's
me.
It's all unconscious.
Yeah, and it's a real physical pathway.
Right, right.
Well, Mary Jo, I wish you the best of luck in quitting smoking. I completely understand how hard that is, believe me. And
How you doing on your New Year's resolution, Ben?
I'm good. I haven't been smoking at all.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
You can do it too, Mary Jo.
Yeah, it's really tough.
I'm trying. That's all I could say. And I'm not a quitter. I mean, you know. I wish I was, but I'm not.
Yeah.
I'm just going to keep trying. But I kind of got the sense that you said, like, instead of reaching for a cigarette, which, you know, at whatever...
Is there something you
experience I'm going through? Replace it kind of in the beginning with something else.
It's yeah, you know, and there are a whole lot of strategies to do that. Send us an email at positivemind@wbai.org, and I'll tell you how I did it.
And we're also going to talk about strategies.
Yeah, we're going to talk tomorrow about 45 days to rewiring your brain chemistry. Dr. Bruning will be back on with us, but we are right up against the end of our show, so we do have to sign off right now. But thanks for the call, and definitely give us a listen tomorrow. We'll be talking about how to change behaviors.
Okay, and I'll email you. Thanks a lot, honey.
Thank you so much.
Okay,
and you've been listening to The Positive Mind. Here in the studio with me is Dr. Loretta Bruning. She's the author of Habits of a Happy Brain, Retrain Your Brain to Boost Your Serotonin, Dopamine, Oxytocin, and Endorphin Levels. You can find the book on Amazon and I think elsewhere as well, right?
Like, yeah, all the usual places.
All the usual places. And Kevin O'Donohue, thanks for joining us again today.
Thank you, Ben.
Great to have you in the studio. And remember, as I just told Mary Jo, you can email us at positivemind@wbai.org. You can also download our podcast, subscribe. It's free. You go to the iTunes store, search Positive Mind, and you get all new episodes automatically downloaded to your computer. And, of course, every Tuesday and Wednesday, we're right here at 99.5 FM, WBAI, New York.